are Locked On Yankees, your daily New York Yankees podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome.
You're listening to the Locked On Yankees podcast, which is part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. I'm your host, Stacey Gotsoulias. You can find us on Twitter at Locked On Yankees, all one word. You can find me on Twitter at StaceGots. Please feel free to tweet questions or comments to either account. If you're a new listener, hello and welcome. If you're a returning listener, welcome back. I hope you all enjoy today's episode. I'm pretty excited about this because I have a guest today. Today is the 20th anniversary of the Yankees beating the Mets in the 2000 World Series, and my guest wrote a book about it, and he will be my guest for today's episode and tomorrow's episode. We had a fun conversation about the Subway Series as a whole, about the game from 20 years ago tonight specifically, and more. But first, you can get Locked On Yankees and all other Locked On podcasts straight to your phone in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Himalaya, Spotify, Stitcher, or anywhere else you get your podcasts. And when you get into your car, you can tell your smart device to play podcast Locked On Yankees. So as I teased at the opening, I actually have a guest today. This is very exciting because, you know, I do this podcast solo and I never have guests. But today is a special day. If you can believe it, it's been 20 years since the Mets-Yankees infamous Subway Series. And it's the 20th anniversary of the Yankees winning that World Series. And my guest wrote a book about it, Jerry Beach, The Subway Series, Baseball's Big Apple Battles, and the Yankees-Mets, 2000 World Series Classic. Jerry, thank you for joining me today.
No problem, Stacey. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
First of all, how is it 20 years?
Man, I don't know. You think, you know, this is as far, we're as far from the World Series now as we were from 1980. In 2000, isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
you think about it in those terms.
Yeah,
it's crazy, and but you know, it's still so vivid. I mean, you know, if you were in New York like we were at that time, and you're a baseball fan, you know, it only lasted 5 or 6 days, but it felt like it lasted 5 or 6 weeks in a good way, because
right,
it was just everywhere you looked. I mean, I remember my wife's late grandmother would go shopping for us every day and bring back more Subway Series stuff, t-shirts, hats. I mean, everybody was into it, whether you were a big baseball fan, young, old. It was just, it dominated the city, you know, for those, actually, I'd say 8 or 9 days, because, you know, they won the pennant, obviously, and there was a few days built up before that. But yes, I mean, it's been 20 years, and it's just still so vivid. And it is hard to believe it's passed. It is hard to believe that much time has passed, though. It's just, it's mind-boggling.
especially when you think everything that's happened in the years since 2000,
right.
You know, the fact that next year we're coming up on the 20th anniversary
right.
of 9/11 is even crazy
right.
to think about.
Right. And like, if you look at, like, I remember when I was, you know, doing the book, it, like, you know, the Yankees won the World Series 11 months later, like everything was different.
Mm-hmm.
That to me is like, it feels further away because everything got so much, everything just changed for everybody. Irrevocably in September 2001. So yes, so if you look at it like that, it's like it really does feel like a real before and after. You know, the World Series before, they kind of got weird, and 2001 certainly feels a lot closer than 2000 does in a lot of ways.
Right. There's yeah. definitely, you know, what's that term? Delineation. Like, there's a line
yeah,
there.
Yeah, yeah, perfect term. Yeah, I was trying to get that too. Yeah, it's hard. I can never say that word, so I didn't try to say it. Yeah, it is. It's like you know, it's just different. It's, you know, 2000. You know, I mean, look at every generation thinks that things were more innocent before a certain time, and you know, every generation is guilty of that. But if you're in New York and you're our age, yeah, things were a lot more simpler. I mean, I remember the World Series ended. With the Yankees winning game 5, obviously, and people stormed the field, you know, a handful of goobers.
Right.
You know, they got on the field. It was funny. Oh, those guys, good for them. They make through security. Then, like, you know, 11 months later, you know, there's ringed gunman on top of Shea Stadium for that first game between the Braves and the Mets after 9/11. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the delineation point, that's a great term. It's everything was a lot different 12 months later, you know?
I went to one game each round in 2001. And the first game that I went to was game two against Oakland. Oh no, I went to two games that round, game two and game five. It was the night that George Bush was speaking on TV. He did an address for the nation and they played it on the scoreboard at the stadium. And you could see snipers in the roof and it was just really tense.
Yeah.
And it was such a difference between that and the year before. Yep. I was at game one of the World Series. And I was thinking about this earlier. Each game had a moment or two that defined each game.
Yep, absolutely.
Game one, you had actually three moments when you think about it. You had the Timo Perez play. You had the Paul O'Neill walk. And obviously, Vizcaíno's walk-off single.
Right.
Game two, you had Clemens acting like an idiot throwing the bat against towards Piazza. And I remember watching that game with my dad. And my dad actually saying, what the hell is he doing? What is wrong with him?
Yeah, it's truly like, in the, you know, I when I wrote the book, I looked back and it lasted like 15 seconds, but like, you'll never forget where you were for it. Or I'm sorry, the thing lasted 15 seconds, but like, you know, the bench is empty and receded within like a minute and the Piazza went back to bat and grounded out.
Right.
But like, that's a minute that like, if you saw it again, it feels like it lasted, you know, 10 hours because you're just like, what are we watching? How is this happening?
I was at the game when Clemens hit Piazza.
Oh, in July, right?
That was my Sunday ticket, and I was with my mom and my dad, and was my brother there? It might not have been my brother. It may have been someone else because he was in college in Florida and he might not have been home then. I can't even remember. I do remember my parents being there. And my dad jokingly, right before he threw the pitch, said, hit him in the head. And I'm like, what the hell? And then 2 seconds later, you know, we're up in the upper deck. We heard it like it was right next to us. And my mom was sitting next to me. She put her head in my shoulder and she's like, is he dead? I'm like, it looks like it, but I think he's okay.
You know? And like, you know, it was really, you know, it's crazy. You know, Sam Chapman, right? The pitch that killed. Mm-hmm. It's crazy that that hasn't happened more often because.
Especially with Piazza said on his throw now.
Yeah. Piazza said, you know, he felt if he didn't throw up his hand at that second they did, you know, he would have been like Tony Conigliaro in the 60s or worse.
Right.
And yeah. And my that was, of course, as you know, that was, of course, the back end of the split stadium doubleheader, the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd bought concert tickets to Steely Dan months earlier. I said, I'm not wasting those tickets. I'm going to that concert.
Right.
I chose wrong there. But yeah. And you know, but yeah, it's
so you
and
have then like that, right. You had that whole buildup because there was a buildup from that. You had it being the first Subway Series since 56.
Yep.
44 right. Years. So, I mean, that's a long time for there not to be a Subway Series. The interleague stuff started a few years earlier. So the rivalry was fired up a bit from that just because they were finally playing each other in games that actually counted. And it wasn't for a stupid mayor's trophy. That didn't mean anything. And it was just, you know, for people all over the country, like you said, for New York, this was such a big deal. For people across the country, they were just like, oh, God, the Yankees are in it again.
I know, because the Yankees were a dynasty. And so even if they lose, a New York team wins.
Right.
So outside of here, I don't think anybody cared. But like Jeff Nelson said, you know, we're the center of the universe, and it's pretty cool. So too bad.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And I mean, New Yorkers always feel that way about New York anyway. So it was perfect.
Right. It was great. It was awesome. We rule.
Let's see. So game two was the Piazza Clemens thing. And also the Mets, you know, nearly coming back in the ninth.
Yeah, I forgot until I looked at it. Todd Zeal missed a homer from Cody Bellinger's dad, made a catch against the left field wall, two more feet, and the Mets might win that game.
Right.
Certainly tie it, might win it.
And that could have really changed the series, even just having them tie it at 1-1.
Right, especially after being down, was it 6-0? Clemens throws a two-hitter. Zeal gets the only hits. Like you said, even the craziest, you know, it wasn't overshadowed. It didn't overshadow Clemens Piazza, but there were many more layers we peeled from that game the next seven innings.
Right. Yeah. Then the series goes to Shea and, you know, El Duque, his line wasn't terrible. for the game. I mean, he pitched 7 1/3. He struck out 12. It was just giving up the 4 runs. And it was kind of like, whoa, someone got El Duque in the playoffs.
El Duque streak ended. The Yankee streak ended. And and the guys that did it for the Mets were the, you know, I always thought that game kind of symbolized the Mets in not just the 2000 season, but their whole existence. Benny Agbayani, a 30th round draft pick who was a replacement player, gets the game winning hit.
Right.
Bubba Trammell adds the game, adds the insurance RBI. Johnny Franco, you know, from New York City, pitched for 1,000 years, had never been in the World Series. You know, every save opportunity had people's hearts in their throats. He gets the win, and the game was started by Rick Reed, another replacement guy who just, you know, was the poor man's Greg Maddux. Every game, 6 innings, 2 or 3 runs, no walks, 3 strikeouts, wasn't pretty, but he kept you in it. And and they ended up like you said, they broke. You know, Duque was, I don't know, had he lost? I'm not sure if he lost a postseason. I don't think he lost a postseason start before that, right?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think that was the first one.
And he saved their season in 98 against Cleveland. Mm-hmm. He was the big game guy, and the Yankees hadn't lost a World Series game in 4 years. So, yeah, now all of a sudden, now you feel, okay, this is a series now, right? And then what happens in game four?
Okay, so this is funny. Back then, I was still living at home. It was about a year before I moved out. And my house is like a smallish center hall colonial. So we have a living room and den back to back. But back then we had TVs in both rooms. Now that game was on a Wednesday night and Dawson's Creek was on. So I was in the living room watching Dawson's Creek, and I could hear. So the game was loud enough. So I was watching Dawson's Creek, but also hearing the game. And I hear my dad go, "Are you kidding me?" And I go, and I run in and I see Jeter rounding the bases.
Yep.
And the hell just happened? He goes, he hit a first pitch home run. I'm like, oh my God. Okay.
Yep.
I went back to watching Dawson's Creek, and then I went and watched the rest.
That had to be near the end of it, right? Dawson's, that was 2000, right? I guess it was midway through its run.
Yes. Midway through.
Okay. Yep. Yeah. So yeah, Jeter, I mean, they felt pretty good about themselves and
it was
the Mets.
Jeter did it.
Right. Paul O'Neill hits a homer bat in third. Great. Whatever. Anybody else, but Jeter on the first pitch against Bobby Jones, who
people are still getting into their seats.
Right. The Baja Man just played.
Right.
Who let the dogs out was still ringing in people's ears. And, before, like Turk Wendell said, I'm sitting in the dugout, actually, outside the dugout. And he said, oh, can we curse on the podcast?
I can. Okay. You can. I'll bleep it.
He said, oh, bleep. The S word. We're in trouble.
Right.
And they never let it. I'm sorry. They let it get in game five, but they never let it in game four.
Right.
And now you're down 3-1.
I should have asked this before, but into the Subway Series, how did you think it was going to go?
That's a good question. I think my wife is a huge Yankees fan, and I was shaking my childhood Mets fandom at the time. So I was leaning a little Mets. And the Yankees, as you know, they were terrible down the stretch. They were 3-15. They needed, not a miracle game five, but they had to go to Oakland in game five, no rest to win that series. And they took care of Seattle pretty easily. But I thought, the Mets, dodged disaster in the first round against the Giants. Benitez blows the save. Franco gets the win. Franco gets the save in game two, and then they cruise. And then they just, they really steamrolled St. Louis once Atlanta was out of the way. I thought the Mets were going to win. I thought I was going seven. I was surprised it went five, and it was a 7-game series in terms of thrills and action and how close it really was. It only went five, but I think my wife will tell you for sure that I thought the Mets were going to win, and I think I thought they did. The Yankees looked like they were on their last legs. The Mets were kind of rolling. They had that they regained the 99 magic, the 99 mojo they had. Mojo rising. I think I thought the Mets were going to win. And I think I still am surprised it didn't go more than five, as good as those games were.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. I thought the Mets were going to win for all the same reasons.
Yep.
I mentioned this a few weeks ago because I've said it on the show a few times. I kept pointing out how horrible September of 2000 was. And it wasn't even just that they were losing. Some of those games, they were getting their asses kicked.
It was like a 19-2 game in there or something, right? They lost to somebody by like 17 runs or something.
Yeah. And there were a few games, those last few games that they lost, they were outscored by a lot. They just really, they were doing really well. And then they fell back to what the pie fag actually was.
Right.
Losses.
We didn't know what that was back then, but yes.
Right.
And they were, Yeah, because I was looking it up because like they hadn't lost two in a row or three in a row for weeks before that 3-15 stretch.
Right.
And then they couldn't. I think I could be wrong, but I think not only did they go 3-15, obviously, they had the worst run diff of over any 18-game stretch that any team did in 2000.
Probably.
So they were bad. Like you said, they weren't just losing 3-1, 3-2, 8-7. They were losing, you know, by a dozen runs. And thank goodness for them that the Red Sox could barely get out of their own way. Because I don't think Boston got any closer than two games.
Right.
That whole stretch. And then Boston lost on Friday night. So the Yankees won without winning. And then they got swept, right, by Baltimore, I think?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah. So they stumbled in with the fewest wins of any team in the playoffs. And so, I mean, and I know they kind of regained it a little bit and they got hot against Seattle, but I still thought, you know, if I got to go back 20 years, I'm pretty sure I thought, you know, if I was placing wagers or making predictions, I would have said the Mets were going to win that series.
Mm-hmm. And I remember, I think Sports Illustrated predicted the Mets were going to win in five.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. The fact that the Yankees were the ones to do it. But then when you think about it, they still had a lot of the core from the previous championships.
Yep.
They knew how to play in the playoffs.
Yep.
You know, I mean, I still, even at the time, was just with the way they backed in. I was like, well, it was a nice run.
Right.
You know,
right. Still dynasty. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, okay. Yeah,
but you're right. They had muscle memory. They really did. Like once they got there, it was like, all right. And they even lost a game one of the Oakland series, right? I think Gil Heredia won it.
I think so. Yeah.
They, but you know, you can't measure it. You can't quantify it, but it was there and no one's had it since because no one's even repeated as a champion. Since the 98 to 2000 Yanks, never mind 1-3, never mind 1-4 out of 5. It should have been 5 out of 6.
Right.
Whatever that was, I think this is just me talking. I think that they didn't know, like they were the first team to do this in the wild card era. They didn't know how draining the wild card era was. Mm-hmm. Now we see it every year. This year you might play, what, 5 rounds, wild card round, 4 rounds to get out this year. So let's say, you know, Rays or Dodgers, whomever wins this thing. You know, that's a lot of wear and tear that they're going to have on the tires next year. And I'm not sure, you know, if you're when you're doing it, you don't know it. And so nobody knew how hard it was. And I think that we've seen, obviously, since then that no one's done it. No one's come close to doing it. I think baseball is the only sport since 2000 that hasn't had a repeat champion.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, whatever, you can't quantify it, but they had something really, really unique and special that very few teams in the history of sports have ever had.
In a moment, Jerry and I will be continuing our conversation about the Subway Series in 2000. But first, let's talk about Built Bar, because you know I love my Built Bar. It's the protein bar that tastes like a candy bar. It comes in 18 amazing flavors, including caramel brownie, cookies and cream, coconut almond, peanut butter, which I haven't tried, but my brother did, and he said it was really good. One of my favorites, mint brownie, salted caramel, toffee almond. The bars are covered in 100% chocolate. They're soft and easy to chew. They're great for the health conscious person. They're great if you just want to maintain weight while indulging in a delicious treat. They're low calorie, low sugar, high protein, high fiber. They're great for the keto diet. And right now, if you go to BuiltBar.com and you use the promo code LOCKEDON, you'll get 20% off your next order. And that means next order. It doesn't need to be your first. It could be your 50th. It could be your 100th. I'm getting close to those numbers myself. Again, use the promo code LOCKEDON for 20% off at BuiltBar.com.
You know, looking back now, because at the time, for me, you know, people around our age, Sully Baseball, Paul Francis Sullivan, has that rule of seven, where when you're seven, that's when you really start, your fandom really kicks in. And for me, I was seven in 1981.
Yep.
And my first real memory was listening to the Yankees lose to the Dodgers on the radio. I was sneaking it in my room. And
that's funny. Not funny that they lost. I'm not
funny
at that.
No.
I was seven in 80, and my best friend from childhood grew up in Connecticut, but he had moved from PA, Pennsylvania. So he was a Phillies fan. So I'm in bed at seven. I turned seven in September of 80. And I hear in the living room, you know, game six, the Phillies are scoring. I'm cheering. My dad's like, go to bed. So it's funny. I never heard that, the rule of seven. But yeah, that's, Yeah, that was a, for me, that was the summer George Brett almost hit 400. I remember reading that in the paper, and yeah, that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. But so yours was you heard the Yankees losing, right?
Yes.
Down 0-2, up 0-2, right, that year? Up 2-0?
I believe so, yes, and then they lost 4.
Yep.
And it was such an odd feeling because it wasn't like I watched full games with my dad, obviously, because I'd have to go to bed if they were on at night.
Right.
But that was the first time I felt a sports loss
in
my life. I cried myself to sleep.
Yep.
I was so upset. And then we had that drought. So by the time 96 happened, I was 22. So I was a fully formed adult and I could appreciate the run that they went on and appreciate actually watching the games and seeing this actually happen and them finally being in the playoffs and winning. You know, 95 was fun just getting in there, but the way they lost was heartbreaking. Yeah. But now that I think about it, you know, Seattle can celebrate all they want because they haven't done anything since.
Right. It's the closest they got since then,
And it actually helped the Yankees go on their run. So
exactly. It did. It really did. I mean, and the guy said in the book, actually wasn't 1995, it was 97 that Torrey said really fueled that team. It was obviously they won 96. It was great. But you think,
97 I broke a TV remote.
Yeah. My wife's, we weren't married yet. We were living together and she stormed out of the room. Bernie made the last out, right?
Yes.
With O'Neill at the second.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She stormed out of the room in our first apartment. And Torrey talked about, you know, had to peel Bernie off the dugout steps after the last out.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, you can't teach that. You either got it or you don't. And O'Neill said, you know, I thought, I'm paraphrasing, but you know, I thought you win a 96, you think, okay, we're going to do this again. And then you don't. But you get that far and everything you did is nullified because you didn't win.
Right.
And the next year, of course, you know, it was 98 and Scott Brosia said, he couldn't believe, because he was in Oakland the year before, obviously, he couldn't believe the focus in spring training. Most times, oh, let's just get our work in, you know, if we win, great, blah, blah, blah. But he said, you know, from day one, you could tell this team was just super focused and super obsessed with winning because of what the sting of 97, and then they won 3 more. It could have been 4 more.
Right. I mean, it really is. While it was happening, it was really a lot of fun, obviously for us, because like I said, we didn't have much to cheer about. We couldn't, you know, too young to remember 77 and 78. Yep. And we had that drought. Not that they were terrible in the 80s. There were a couple of years where they were close. And if there was a wild card round, they probably would have made it in.
We might've had an 85 Subway Series.
Right.
Yankees had 99 wins, Mets had 98, and they both finished second.
Right. It's crazy.
Yeah.
I always felt bad for the Giants in, what was it, 93 when they won 103?
The last great pennant race. Yeah. They were up about 20 games all summer. They won 103 games and missed out.
Right. Crazy.
Yep.
So, okay, let's set the stage for October 26, 2000.
Yep.
Unbelievable, first of all, again, that it's 20 years because. God.
Just gone by fast.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's going on?
So the Yankees are up 3-1 and thinking, okay, the game's in Shea. Maybe the Mets will make this a series again. You know, because you're, again, like we said, as good as the Yankees had been doing in the series and how they've done in the past, they were just so bad in the regular season. It's like, how did this happen? Because like you said, the Mets were a better team.
Yeah. They won 94 games, I think, and finished the game behind the Braves and just a really solid, consistent team all year.
Yeah. So 94,
this is ending five. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you don't think it's gonna end to five. And yet, you know, they go up 3-1 and, you know, that game was just, you know, so many ebbs and flows to it. I mean, Al Leiter with a RBI infield was a swinging bunt single, I think. And then, you know, and then you look at something else. You talk about, you know, how much time has gone by and how different things are now. You know, watching game five again, I don't think they say anything about his pitch count till the eighth inning.
Right.
You know, he's at 100 and was the end of 140 something, right? 141.
Mm-hmm.
And he would have, you know, the way, especially Al Leiter, he was not an efficient pitcher. You know, he walked a lot of guys and threw a lot of pitches and grunted every time. You know, it's just like, it was such a different game.
Right.
And like, you know, Bobby V said, you know, it's been 20 or 19 years. I haven't had a single second thought about taking him out. He was my best pitcher. I'm going to, you know, win or lose with him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Joe McEwing said, you know, how do you, you can never second guess that because he's your best pitcher, he's your heart and soul. And, you know, and they were, he was one pitch away from getting out of it and getting to the ninth inning. And Jeff Nelson had said he'd been, you know, up and down all game, and he was just, he had nothing left
right.
after all the warmups. So, you know, if he gets out of that ninth inning with, you know, before the 1,000 hopper, you know, and like you said, you know, you think the Mets are going to win. Mm-hmm. And if, you know, it, or you just think, because it's a good series and they're so closely matched. And if they win, we all know what game six is, the rematch.
Right. Yes.
And, you know, what's going to happen there? Is it going to be a brawl? Is it going to be, it's just like, all as crazy as those 6 to 9 days were, imagine how much crazier it would have been with two more days of Clemens Piazza buildup.
Right.
you yeah. know, if the Mets had somehow won that game.
and, you know, both starters, you know, Pettit threw 129 yeah. pitches.
Yep.
You know,
yeah. and that's the same boat. Not, you know, not very efficient, but just guts and guile and, mm-hmm. you know, yeah, it's his game until it's not. Yeah. Yeah. It was a great matchup.
You know, now, you know, even last night's game, you know, they took Urias out too early.
Yep. 4 2/3, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah. he was at 80 pitches. It wasn't like he was close to 100. They could have kept him in a little longer.
Yep.
It's just so different now. And even, yep. Looking at the box score from this game in 2000, the Yankees had three pitchers. The Mets only yep. had two, Leiter and yep. Franco. Last night, the Rays, I mean, they were lucky that game didn't go into extra innings because they had nearly, I don't think they had maybe two guys
they,
left.
They had Ryan Sheriff, the little user reliever, whose name I remember because I always think of the 80s song When I'm With You.
Nope.
And of course, I had to drop that in there. And they had one other guy. I can't off the top of my head, but like, yeah, and like I remember, it's kind of come back together. Al Leiter was saying on MLB Network last night or yesterday afternoon that this is a game seven for the Rays. You got to figure out a way to win this game so you don't fall behind 3-1.
Mm-hmm.
And they did.
Right.
But it's just such a, it wouldn't have happened 20 years ago. 20 years right. ago, you would have had a starter and he would have gone six, hell, Harry Water, and then you would have pieced it together with your bullpen. But that's how it is. So,
yeah.
Can't progress, right?
Yeah. It's really funny, though, looking at the box scores. There was that one game between the A's and the White Sox in the wild card.
Oh, this year, yeah, yeah.
Where yeah. I think 12 or 13 pitchers were used. It was like 7 on one team, 5 on the other. And
yeah, it was something like back-to-back games, back-to-back days.
Mm-hmm.
Teams used at least 8 pitchers in a game that didn't go extra innings. It had never happened
right.
before this year. Yeah. And it's just tedious. You know, it wasn't like game seven, throw 20 pitchers. It's great. I don't care. It's a game seven. But like, you
right.
know, in a game two, like, oh, geez, it's got to be a better way to do this.
and the other thing that I'm noticing, and I've said this a few times on Twitter, I've said it a few times on my show. There are so many guys who throw 98 and 99, like yep. with regularity, like yep. it's no big thing to them. It's like, yep. are these guys grown in a lab? Where are they yep. coming from?
The thing, you know, Benitez in that ninth inning in game one, you know, O'Neill, you know, didn't have a prayer. He thought because he was struggling and, you know, the fast, you know, throw 98, 99. But that's the only guy in that bullpen who threw 98, 99.
Right. right.
Now, it was a big deal.
Guys.
yeah.
Yeah.
It was like big, you know, it was a big deal if a guy hit 100. Now it's like, oh, okay, he's throwing the fifth inning. Good for him.
right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Now it's like, you know, they're hitting 102 and you're like, whoa.
Yeah. And stars are hitting that too. I mean, Syndergaard was hitting it regularity. And it's just like, okay. It's like, you know, this is another tangent, but it's like, you know, home runs were really cool when they didn't happen a lot. And guys throwing 100 was cool when it didn't happen a lot. Now it's happening all the time. It's like, okay, it's normal, I guess. That's cool too.
Yeah. And it's like, are we going to get to the point where, you know, if the world is still around in 25 yeah. years, are guys going to be touching 105 and almost hitting 110? Like, it's crazy to even think about.
I'm certainly not. If I had the skills to figure that stuff out, I wouldn't be a sports writer. But I'm not sure the body can throw much harder than what the Aroldis Chapman's thrown and
right.
and Garrett Richards threw before he got hurt and stuff like that. But I don't know. Like you said, in 20 years, it'd be interesting to find out if somebody's throwing
a
buck five.
Is, a lot of these guys are also like Tyler Glass now is 6'8".
Yeah.
Like there are so many of these. You know, Dellin Betances is 6'8". Andrew Miller is 6'8". Like all yep. these guys, these giant guys where like Randy Johnson
right.
was a freak of nature because he was 6'10 and so out of place with everyone else. You had Pedro Martinez who was tiny and you still have small guys. You have Marcus Stroman,
sure.
you have mm-hmm. Davey Garcia, you know, other guys who are small, but I'm also seeing these giants coming out of bullpens and it's just like, is this going to become a regular thing? Because 20 years ago when Jeter, Garcia Parra, you know, before that Ray Ordonez, like when these shortstops came out and they were 6'2", 6'3", 6'4", that was
right.
out of the ordinary.
Right. And Cal Ripken was the kind of like the prototype, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. Like, yeah. He was the one where we were like, whoa, he's really big. And now you have DJ LeMay, who's playing second and third, right. He's 6'4".
Yep.
It's just like everyone, it seems everyone's getting bigger and they're bigger throwing and things harder.
Yeah. Bigger, taller, and harder. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember watching, like, you know, Randy Johnson took forever to kind of get it together because he was 6'10 with his body flying, his mechanics flying all over the place. And now these guys are figuring out much earlier than that and putting it together much earlier than he ever did. And it's just, you know, yeah. Like, what will we see in 20 years? Will be a 7'2" guy
right.
on the
right.
mound throwing 98, looks like 120 because he's coming at you from, you know, 40 feet away.
Right.
It's it's fascinating. And it's just like, you know, you saw one guy, two guys, it was something. Now it's like everybody, you know, was it Kevin Cash expression? I got a whole damn stable of guys that throw 98, and he does. He's not alone.
He's not even lying.
Yeah, he's not lying. He's not exaggerating. He's not alone.
So you had mentioned Luis Soho's 100 bouncer, and it's so funny because, you know, your memory plays tricks on you because we all think of it as, like, I always joked it was a 38 bouncer up the middle, and it really only bounced like 3 times, but it felt like it bounced 500 times before it made it into the outfield. Mm-hmm. And that play in itself was just so, you know, you had Brocious rounding the bases, the ball hits. Wait, did it hit Piazza and then Brocious scored, right?
Hit Piazza and Brocious raced home.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was just such a strange play. And again, Leiter was in there for so long. It was his 142nd pitch.
Yep.
And, you know, when the Yankees scored those runs, I thought to myself, holy shit, they're doing this again.
Yeah.
This is actually going to happen. And then, you know, the bottom of the ninth was kind of exciting.
Yeah. The ball actually hit Posada. Posada scored the first one. I just looked it up.
I meant
the Brocious waving his arms behind him.
Right.
But yeah, yes. The bottom of the inning, you know, we end up getting only the third and most recent World Series ending out between Hall of Famers. And I think at the time we knew Piazza was going. Rivera was great, but only been a handful of years. It's hard to remember now, but it's only been what 4 years at that point, right?
Right.
As the closer. So, you know, closers, it's a fungible job. You know, they burn out. I'm not sure any of us thought we were watching a unanimous Hall of Famer there, but yeah. And I'll never forget it's not just, you know, Rider's Liberty. It was midnight.
Yeah.
The stroke of midnight. Mm-hmm. And he connected and, you know, everybody thought the ball was gone. Torrey thought the ball was gone. I should say everybody. A lot of people thought the ball was gone. Brocious, O'Neill, Todd Zeal was sitting in the on-deck circle, and he kind of saw the way, you know, it was a cold night. It was like October, obviously. If it's July, it's gone. But it wasn't. Zeal thought it was going to be caught. Bobby Valentine thought, he said he watched, you know, every game from the same vantage point for superstition. He'd seen, obviously, every one of Piazza's home runs at Shea Stadium. He thought that one was gone off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, later on, you know, years and years later, he said, I always thought that ball was hit as hard as the ball he hit against Steve Carsey in September 21st, 2001.
Right.
He goes, that ball is still flying. He goes, why did that ball fly and the last out of the World Series, you know, perish in the warning track? It's like, and he said, he talked to someone who said he did a study and that jet travel could slow down the ball in the air. The jets flying in the air create a drag. And he's like, and what happened in 9/11? There are no bleeping planes.
Right.
Or September 21st. There are no bleeping planes. So, of course, the ball flew out.
Right.
So, yeah. So, you know, he got all of it. I mean.
Yeah, he really did.
You hear the sound of the bat. He got all of it. And, but, you know, within a second. Now, that's easy to say now because we watched it 1,000 times in replays. But, you know, Bernie knew where it was. And I think it got just shy of the warning track. And that was that. At midnight, you know, the Cinderella went home. You know, the party ended at midnight.
And that ends part one of my discussion of the Subway Series from 2000 with author Jerry Beach. I hope you all enjoyed it. Stay tuned for part two tomorrow, where we discuss more from the night that the Yankees won and other baseball stuff. We got into other conversations, including the stuff that's going on now with COVID and the bubbles and allowing fans to see baseball. So please tune in for that tomorrow. And for now, that's it for this episode of Locked On Yankees, which is part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. I'd like to remind you that you can subscribe to this show in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Himalaya, Spotify, Stitcher, or anywhere else you get your podcasts. And when you get into your car, you can tell your smart device to play podcast Locked On Yankees. One more thing, if you could be so kind, please rate the podcast and spread the word about this podcast to your fellow Yankee fans. We would really appreciate it. Enjoy your Monday, and I will talk to you all tomorrow.